My name is Dev, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Phil and Dino, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or your understanding. Harry will read the preamble.
Hi, my name is Harry. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Tara will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Tara. I'm an alcoholic. 12 steps. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Step eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Step 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Hillary will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Hillary and I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other group or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA, such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Tonight is anniversary night. The format of the meeting will be: the 10-minute speaker will speak on the 5 traditions, followed by our information break. The main speaker will speak for 25 minutes, followed by our anniversary celebrants. Our 10-minute speaker is Debbie.
Hi, I'm Debbie. I'm an alcoholic. And I will be speaking on the 5th tradition. I don't think in 10 minutes we could speak on all 5. I'll begin by reading the 5th tradition in the long form. Tradition 5, long form. Each Alcoholics Anonymous group ought to be a spiritual entity having but one primary purpose, that of carrying its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Tradition 5 in the short form. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. My name is Debbie Young, and I'm an alcoholic. Tradition 5, when Heidi called me a couple weeks ago to speak on Tradition 5, it's an honor and it's a pleasure. I get the opportunity to serve the group to pick the 10-minute female speaker. So when people called me up and said, oh, you picked yourself to speak, I want to thank Heidi for asking me to speak and doing service in the group. I'm here tonight because I suffer from alcoholism. And what the 5th tradition talks about is it's written at the group level, and there's a difference between the steps and the traditions. The steps, when I came in here, were all about me, how I could get better, everything about me. So I wasn't concerning myself with the 12 traditions. And later on, a couple of years later, I was still in a lot of pain, and I was introduced to the 12 traditions. No, you don't understand. They're boring. I drink coffee, during coffee break. That's why we read them on Sunday, on Sunday night we used to read them, I think, after the coffee break or something. That's when we fall asleep. And, as I grew in Alcoholics Anonymous, it was brought to my attention how important the 12 traditions were. And the 5th tradition is the cornerstone for Alcoholics Anonymous. When Bill wrote the traditions, he wrote them out of experience. There was a group in the 1800s that disappeared. They grew to about 500,000, kind of similar to this group. We're at 500, and this group grew over 3 years, and they disappeared. And why they disappeared is because they got involved in other activities, in abolition, in temperance movements. They got involved into fighting. And the 5th tradition, it's about one primary purpose. And I hear a lot about singleness of purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous. What's singleness of purpose? Singleness of purpose is the same thing as primary purpose. It's one purpose. This group, Alcoholics Anonymous, has one purpose. One primary purpose. The sole purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. If I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and there was a lot of other things going on, there's meetings for Al-Anon, there's meetings for gambling, there's other meetings. If I came in here and I didn't find a solution to my disease, the spiritual solution, I didn't hear about alcohol, I probably would have left. And I came in with a lot of other issues. And I didn't understand, well, why are we just talking about alcohol? Don't you understand? I'm a, and the 5th tradition clearly states, each group, it's talking about the group. And I thought, because it talked about the group, it's your responsibility, maybe like the steering committee in this group, or your responsibility if you have that service commitment to keep that primary purpose. But I can talk about it. And it was explained to me the difference between AA and self-help. AA is not a dumping ground, and Bill clearly says that in the 5th tradition. He talks about in his talks at Akron, about primary purpose. We have one purpose. If I'm not carrying the message to the alcoholic, I'm going to die. You know, if we didn't have this group today, we might all die. And the difference between the steps and the traditions, if the steps aren't here, I might die, or I might just suffer from alcoholism the rest of my life. But with the 12 traditions, it's about the group. You know, and somebody said to me once, why don't you personalize the 12 traditions in your life at the eye level? I was like, what do you mean, the eye level? You know, I have but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Well, that takes a whole different approach, you know, a different understanding, is that I have one primary purpose. Well, what's the primary purpose? I got to talk to another alcoholic. You know, if I'm talking to people with other substances, which I came in with a lot of other stuff, I can't identify, or they might not identify. And I've worked with a lot of women who can't identify with the other stuff that I came in. And it was clearly, you know, and the message is very clear, one primary purpose. You know, what's the message? You know, I hear a lot of, you know, from people I work with, what's the message? You know, and it's very clear. Thank you. Carry its message. Message to the alcoholic who still suffers. The message is written in the 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, you know, as a result of these steps, tried to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers, and practice these principles in all of my affairs. You know, so what's the message? The message is the 12 steps. AA is the 12 steps. You know, I first went to meetings, you know, when I first got sober, I came here from California, and I went to a lot of meetings, you know, and I heard meeting makers make it, so I thought 3 meetings will keep me sober. I went to great meetings. I went to meetings where we talked about, like, all my problems, and we sat around, and I felt more miserable when I left. And, you know, I love this group. And the reason why I love this group is because I suffer from alcoholism. And if you give me a different solution, I may not be here tomorrow. So when Bill talks about one alcoholic talking to another, you know, I need to remember that. You know, I can only identify if you're another alcoholic. If you're telling me about other stuff, I might not be able to identify. You know, and you know, I can't identify with people that have one drink. I just can't. You know, I just came back from my father's. He has a whiskey sour. He sips on it. You know, he doesn't get the whole thing down. You know, I would have already had 3. You know, I can't identify. How can he identify with me? He's not an alcoholic. You know, and in the 12th step, it talks about as a result of these steps. So I come in here, and what happens? You know, I need to qualify myself. You know, people ask me, you know, why are you an alcoholic? And they had to explain to me, what is an alcoholic? And it's defined in the big book on page 44. You know, there's a couple of questions. Can you control the amount you take? You know, can you stop on your own? You know, and the traditions talk about how am I, you know, explaining the limitations to a newcomer about Alcoholics Anonymous. Are we a lending institution? You know, there's a difference between, I don't have $20 for dinner tonight, could you loan me $20, or I'm going to give you $20. But hey, wait a second, this group makes a lot of money. Why don't they give loans? Why aren't there a lot of freebies? You know, and the fifth tradition, you know, talks about it's my job in Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of these steps to explain what are the limitations. What are the limitations to the new person coming in? You know, I expected everything when I came in here. You know, I thought it was a dumping ground. I was like, thank God they're finally going to hear me. You know, and I remember calling the women 15 times a day. I think some of them changed their numbers or just, you know. And bring it back to the big book. In the foreword to the first edition, the authors wrote, more than 100 men and women have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body to show others how we have recovered. So why am I talking about anything else? You know, when someone calls me up and we start talking about jobs and we start talking about money, and, you know, I need to remember my primary purpose, because I'm identifying with you as an alcoholic. I suffer from alcoholism, and I'm going to die if I don't treat myself, you know, on a daily basis with that spiritual solution. You know, when you speak on the traditions, you need a little notes, because it's not like you're telling your story. You're not qualifying yourself as an alcoholic. I am an alcoholic, and the reason why I'm here is because I couldn't control the amount I take. But the job of the traditions person at the end of each month is to speak to the traditions. You know, in this group, we have a group conscience, what we inform the 10-minute speaker, and I'm assuming the 30-minute speaker, the 2 10-minutes, is that when you talk about alcohol, talk about alcoholism, and if you have other substances in your story, mention it and move on. That's our current group conscience. It could change. It's a current group conscience. You know, and I need to remember that. Thank you. You know, I, Debbie Young, can participate as a citizen. I'm a Sagittarian. You know, I have political views. But, you know, in this group, I need to not divert from the message, because Bill says very clearly on page 150 of the 12 of 12, we do one thing. We do one thing well, then many things badly. And the alcoholic that I am, I came in here, well, don't you guys understand? I know you've got 300 membership. This was 7.5 years ago. I could fix it. We could do better. We could grow this membership. You know, Bill was all about growing the membership. You know, but with the traditions grew out of experience, out of failures of other groups. And Bill just didn't wake up and learn about the traditions. I mean, the Washingtonians, that group who diverted. He got a letter from another alcoholic saying, hey, do you remember those drunkards in the 1800s? He never heard the story, you know. So I need to remember what my primary purpose is here. You know, it's to help the alcoholic. It's to help the alcoholic that still suffers, you know, because I can only identify, you know, with you if you're identifying with me. If we're talking about other stuff and I'm diverting from the primary purpose, you know, I'm probably going to lose my sobriety here. And unless I give it away, I'm not going to keep it. Thank you.
And our main speaker tonight is Melissa.
My name's Melissa. I'm an alcoholic. Can you, everybody hear me? I had surgery recently, and I don't think I can stand up for 25 minutes, so thanks. Thank you, Heidi. Thank you. It is an honor to speak at any AA meeting, and I have never been in a room with this many beginners, so welcome all of you. Keep coming back. I was told to sit up front, and I didn't bring a guest with me because you guys are my guests. But if there's a beginner in the back someplace, there's a seat next to me if you want to move up front. Okay. somebody that helped get me sober. I grew up in the 1950s in California with cocktail parties, being given by my parents and all their friends, and I think my first awareness of alcohol were these cocktail parties. And I came out with little trays with hors d'oeuvres and passed them around and listened to, you know, all the cocktail talk, and it seemed extremely glamorous to me. And drinking for me, I thought was glamorous up until the last night I drank. It was not something I thought I had a problem with. I never thought my problem was alcoholism. When I got to AA, my problem was my life. I really had no clue I was an alcoholic, and thank God I found out. I was very uncomfortable as a little girl. I was remembered the other day. I mean, I put my little dress on, and if I didn't like the way the bow was in the back, I was probably 4. I was very upset, and I don't think it was a fashion issue. I was just uncomfortable all the time. And the first memory I have is taking glasses down from the kitchen, little glasses that my parents had that were for, I think, sherry, something like that. And I would bring a glass down, I would put on my mother's high heels, I would get an unlit cigarette, I would put milk in the little glass, and I would strut around in the backyard of our house looking at myself in the plate glass window. And that's it. I mean, I don't know where I got that. I mean, I was too young to be actually serving hors d'oeuvres at the cocktail parties. I just had this thing about when I get like a year older, I would imagine my lover, my Italian lover across the swimming pool and, you know, coming to get me. And I mean, this started when I was unbelievably young, and all I wanted to do was just grow up and live that life. And I did. And I couldn't do it soon enough. But in those years, in my early sort of years, I don't know, I got into high school, and my first real alcohol drink was at a wedding, as I've heard so many times. I was about 13, got smashed. And then during my high school years, my parents went through a... I come from a family with a tremendous amount of alcoholism, a lot of dead people. One of them, I'll just say it now when I think of it, one of them had the big book next to his bed when he blew his brains out. I take this really seriously. But my parents had an alcoholic, dramatic marriage, and it was just screaming and yelling all the time, or a really fun, one or the other. And so the taste for drama was just it was just set in stone in me. And then my father ran off with my best friend's mother, and more drama. And then I got a ton of attention, and so my self-pity and my self-centeredness, and you know, was just fed by that. I mean, not to say it wasn't horrible, it was horrible. But that sort of started a big depression. I was in high school, I was very depressed. I'm a person who's suffered from depression most of my life and many bouts in sobriety. And I know I was certainly drinking to medicate that. And so I made it through high school, pretty average student. And I now understand that I've got certain sort of dyslexia, I've got problems that if we'd understood then, it might have gotten more help than I did. But I set off for college to, you know, lead this fabulous life I was going to lead. And I was never happy wherever I got. And the other thing about drinking is that at the end of my senior year in high school, I was a debutante, if anyone knows what that is. I don't know if they still have them. But what it meant essentially was that the pillars of the community were plying their kids with booze and giving them parties. And it was California, it was, the drinking age was 18, and, you know, now you'd have the cops coming over to, you know, arrest the parents for such thing, and in my day, the cops were there to just make sure nobody got in to the party. So, again, alcohol was, I was above the law, I was above, there was nothing wrong with drinking. There was no concept that there could ever be anything wrong with drinking. Never heard the word alcoholism. That summer is when I really started drinking, and it was really fun, and it relaxed me. It did all the things that alcohol, let me put it this way, I really hated myself. I had this incredible, you know, low self-esteem we talk about, but I had real self-hatred, loathing. I thought I was stupid. I thought I was ugly, and I sort of wanted to die a lot. And when I had a drink of alcohol, I suddenly, and I mean suddenly, was smartest person in the room, the most attractive person in the room. I mean, my IQ went through the ceiling. I was, you know, everything was great. And I was great, and everybody was great. And my life seemed, you know, wonderful. Alcohol had that big of an impact on me. And so obviously I enjoyed drinking it. Didn't get into any trouble. I just had no clue I was an addict. I started smoking. I smoked 4 packs a day for years and years. And off I went to college, and wherever I got, I was unhappy. So I went to 5 different colleges. And, you know, each one was fantastic as soon as I got there, and it's the story of my entire life. It was everything. Started off on some, this is relationships as well as colleges, as well as everything. I'd start off on some fabulous alcoholic high, and then, you know, sooner or later, the person, the place, the college, the guy, the whatever, became the problem. And I usually stayed in the problem for quite a while. And that was it. That was there. And then I'd leave and move someplace else. We call it doing geographics. So I bounced around and landed in, and nothing was thought out. I mean, it's just hard for me to believe that there was a life with no thought whatever about what the next move was going to be. I saw a sign on a board at the fourth college I went to, you're abroad in Paris. So I went to Paris and I stayed for 10 years. And I used to always just wonder why my life just had no, you know, direction. So I landed in Paris. I was there for, as I say, 10 years. My drinking there was never a problem because everybody, you know, everything, we all drank all the time. I was in a school where at the cafeteria they had wine at lunchtime. I ended up getting a job and I married my first husband who was great. I mean, this is also a story of my life. You know, I've heard it said that an alcoholic is somebody who will break their own heart. And that's what I did. Every great thing that happened to me, I screwed it up. Oops, is that bad? I'm sorry. I really don't swear much. Borderline, huh? You know, I wrecked it. I would wreck everything good that would happen to me. And it was always, you know, somebody else's fault. So I hung out there. Finally, Paris was the problem. Drank. Again, drinking there was all dinner parties. My drinking really took place at dinner parties and in restaurants. I did not drink alone at home until the end of my drinking. I never identify with that when people talk about it, but it doesn't. The first meeting I went to, I think the person was drank only at home alone, and I totally understood how she felt, but I didn't identify with that. So my drinking was always in this public arena. But anyway, that became the problem. So I left Paris. I moved to New York. Okay, we better get sober here. I was here. It got worse and worse. I was in my 30s. Just drank through my 30s, looking desperately for husband number two. Wanted to have a baby. That was going to solve everything. Was at a party. One night, down in Soho, in the in the 80s. Oh my God, sounds like my cell phone. I came in with somebody's iPhone and I didn't know how to turn it off, so it'll stop. I thought we did that. Okay, I'm sorry. I was at a party. A woman said, "Here comes so and so." I didn't even turn around. The guy, here's so-and-so, he's smart, he's funny, blah. And I said, this is my next husband. And I did that thing that I think alcoholics do really, really well, which is I turned around and I kind of set my guns on this guy. And my, you know, and that was it. And it's sort of the story of my life. I used to get what I wanted. And then I'd hate what I wanted, and that would be the problem. So anyway, this guy did not know what hit him. I went after this guy. A year later, we're planning this enormous wedding, and I'm planning because I'm in control of everything. And I admit that I did not love him. He was a very nice guy. I probably shouldn't say. His family owned a huge wine business in New York, and they drank champagne like it was tap water. I loved everything about the guy and his family, but I didn't love him, and I didn't really want to marry him. I just wanted to have a baby. So this dramatic wedding got planned, and I was obsessed. The obsession that I, you know, this part of this disease was, it's one of the ways I just didn't feel anything. I just obsess about everything. So obsession about the wedding, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I'll just cut it short. It completely blew up. Like the New York Times was calling, the thing was being called off. It was high, high, high drama. And it really helped me. I thank that guy. I mean, if it weren't for that entire episode, I might not have crashed to my bottom as fast as I did. And I was suicidal, and on a very gorgeous day in October, I left my office. I still had a job, miraculously, with a post-it of my to-do list at lunchtime, and one of the things was I was going to an arms and armor shop, Fifth Avenue, where Takashimaya is now. They tore the whole building down, I'm glad to say, across from St. Thomas, and I went to buy a gun to blow my brains out. And one cousin had gotten sober, and I just knew, I'd heard about AA. I called AA. I've been sober since that day. I went to a meeting, and I have not had a drink since then. But I was a mess. I was taking a lot of prescription drugs, and I just stopped everything immediately, and it's just a miracle I was in New York, because there are so many meetings, and I was going to about 5 meetings a day. I went from one to another in a cab. I just tore around town. And, like, there were ambulances, these cabs that were getting me to my meetings. And I went to, you know, my first meeting had to be on Park Avenue because I, you know, and I really needed that. I needed to see that alcoholics look like you. But then I went everywhere. I went to the midnight meeting. I went around the clock. I went everywhere. And I was out of it. I was a mess. I didn't know a step from a hole in the wall. You know, I couldn't take much in, but I was going and going. And I got a sponsor. I wouldn't let her use the word God. I would not allow her to say that word. I got here. I was a suicidal atheist when I got here. And I must say, I love, you know, it's incredible, the Atlantic Group, but if this had been my first meeting, it would have been really, I wouldn't have come back. Because I was in such a dark, dark place, and I needed some really dark meetings in those early days, and you know, but I did everything I was, you know, was suggested, which is unbelievable. I mean, I came and I went in the midst of all these meetings. I had 75 days, and I heard a guy talking about God, and it just, I wanted what he had, and told him that, and went up from there. It was at the studio. It was Christmas time, and I left that meeting. And I went over to the Metropolitan Museum because I wanted to look at the Christmas tree. And I was looking at the tree, and I started to feel this incredible feeling that I had never felt, which was a peace. You know, that black hole started to close. And I started crying, which I also did for 2 years, by the way. If there's anybody new who hasn't stopped crying, don't worry about it. Keep coming back. But I started crying in front of the tree, and I thought, this is holiday sentimentality. And I thought, let me see if I move to another room, if I can still feel this feeling of peace. And so I went upstairs, and there's the Rembrandt room. There's a late Rembrandt portrait. And I sat down in front of, or I sat on the bench in that room for an hour, I think, and just sobbed. And the guards kept coming over and saying, you all right? And I'd suddenly, I'd loved art my whole life. I'd loved that. And I just got a connection. I knew there was more to that painting than Rembrandt's talent. And I knew I was connected to it and that there was a higher power. And so that was sort of step two. And I just, you know, I just kept coming. And a lot's happened in these years. I have certainly worked the steps. I took two, I just told you. Four, I did all that early in sobriety. I learned from that basically what I've already said, which is I hated everybody. I was afraid of everything. I slept with everybody, and it was all your fault. And that's the short version that I've heard. I didn't make that up. But that's true for me. And in that fourth step, I found out, even though I'd had 5 years, 5 days a week, Freudian psychoanalysis on a couch, I found out doing my fourth step that I had a part. It was all me. So I got to begin to figure out how to, you know, deal with me rather than point the finger at you. Did 5 and 6 and 7 and all of that. And I just, what's happened in sobriety is that I've had a real life. You know, I've had a life that's been amazing. And fantastic, and it's truly miraculous that I'm not dead and didn't blow my brains out. But you know, it's also been very real. And I got married early in sobriety. I think it's an incredible suggestion not to date in the first year, and I didn't do that. But when I had 11 months, I did. I went to London and met a guy in a meeting, and we've been married since then, so which is almost 19 years. And but it was, you know, being married is, they say, two alcoholics marrying in early sobriety is like two garbage trucks colliding. And so we've had 19 years to kind of separate our stuff and all that. And so, you know, it's great, and it's hard, and it's wonderful. And within a year of our marriage, we lost a baby. you know, it's funny remembering it now, and I didn't drink. You know, it was the old days when you had answering machines, and there would be, like, the tape would be full from all the people in AA, and then we had a memorial service. It wasn't, this church wasn't this big, but it was just, like, climbing from the walls. People I had never knew from AA, of course, were there. So, got through that, didn't drink, and everything else that, you know, that comes our way in life. And one of the things I do treasure the most that's happened to me in sobriety is that when my mom got sick and was dying, I was there, and I took a leave of absence. Oh, this really, you know, this gets me, because I just adored my mom. And, you know, but we'd had a volatile relationship. The steps worked, we worked all that out, and I was there with her, holding her when she died. And it was just such a gift, you know. And I know there are a lot of people who've done that and know that, you know, are part of that club. And I wouldn't have been if I hadn't been sober. So what do I do these days? I go to a meeting every day. I still go to a meeting every day. I'm in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I have sponsees, and I adore them. It's interesting, you know, thinking about the traditions tonight. I've got two sponsees coming out with memoirs, they're writers. And so we've been looking a lot at the traditions and how you do or don't talk about recovery. I came here, and I only stayed here because of Tradition 3. You know, I did want to stop drinking. I thought there was a problem, and I knew my life was unmanageable. But, you know, the traditions are what are keeping this place alive and therefore keeping me alive. I knew I would. I usually speak for about 15 minutes. How am I doing? Oh, I have 5 minutes. Okay. I've been having a really difficult time this year. The hardest thing that's ever happened to me is happening to me right now. And I had surgery a year ago. Something went wrong. The doctor did something wrong post-surgery. And I've been in this struggle for a year with this problem. And I just had surgery 3 weeks ago. It doesn't look like it's been terribly successful. And I have I have pain, which I've never had. Chronic pain, and I've been in really bad shape. I don't know where Dev is, because I want to meet Dev, but Dev's mother, who's a very good friend of mine, said to me a couple weeks ago, she said, look, in the state you're in, self-pity would be a step up. So I've been trying to achieve self-pity lately. But, you know, I don't know the future. It's completely uncertain. I cannot fix it, and it's brought up two huge character defects, which is fear and anger. I'm getting angry about this doctor who I you know, is responsible in my view. And I think a lot of people think he is. But it's just what it is now. And, you know, I've watched people go through all the stuff that we go through. Great friend who's had chronic pains, and she burned her back hideously, as many people know, Jane Cecil. I call her every morning and say, how are you doing? And she always says, never better. And she means it, you know. She's got it. I want what she has. It's amazing. I heard a guy, this is how I can close. I heard a guy speak here. I don't come to this meeting. I mean, I've been here a few times, but I heard a guy speak here one night, and I was very taken with what he had to say. And he teaches a big book study. I'm sure a lot of you know Kevin. And I took that big book study, and it was great. And I walked away, it was a couple years ago, and with one thing that just has been haunting me since then, which is he said, if you're not inconveniencing yourself, you're not doing service. And, you know, I just, it's really stuck with me. I must not have felt I was inconveniencing myself enough. And so lo and behold, I've started an AA meeting, and I can't believe it. It's really inconvenient. It's on a Saturday morning when I have a house in the country. And it's been so great, because I've been in such, you know, with my eyes and all the stuff that's been going on, it's just been amazing to show up. And what we're hoping is that you know, one of these Saturday mornings, somebody's going to come to their first meeting and stay sober. Thanks.